Lex Coach Mike here, LexCoachMike.com. Premium guys, love you to death. Man, I've been trying to get this guy. I'm so excited. Today we got Andrew McKinn. He's in his seventh season as the head coach at Robert Morris University. Been there 13 seasons altogether. 2017 Northeast Conference Coach of the Year. 2012 Northeast Conference Coach. Anyway, the amazing thing to me is this guy's from Pittsburgh, man. And to find a D1 head coach that had the season that Robert Morris had last year, including that scare in the NCAA tournament last year, really unbelievable team and program and a real force to be reckoned with. I so enjoyed this dialogue, and I hope you do too. Premium guys, love you to death. Without further ado, Andrew McKinn, a coach you're going to hear a lot more about. Robert Morris, D1.
Hey, Lex Coach Mike here, LexCoachMike.com. Coach, this is that radio voice that I was telling you about. Man, I followed this team because they're near and dear to my heart. We've gotten about 5 or 6 emails, especially after last year's tournament. We have Coach McKinn on from Robert Morris University in beautiful Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Coach, welcome to LexCoachMike.com.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
A little more enthusiasm would be good, Coach. You know, normally we get people that marvel about our site here and tell me how great we are. And, I mean, if you want to get right to it, I'm cool with that, just so you know the protocol.
Hey, we just spoke about that. But, yeah, no, absolutely. Like I said, we use the site quite a bit. And you know,
oh, don't be patronizing me now, Coach. Don't be patronizing me now. Hey, Coach, give us a quick rundown. I know you've been there almost since the beginning. And I think everybody knows who you are now, man, but, can you give me just a 2-minute sketch of the, growth of the program and, where you are today in terms of, the roster and how you feel about the program going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we started out in 2005, so kind of past the point of calling ourselves a newer program now, but, it's certainly been, you know, a very, very awesome path to experience with being, you know, at the grassroots of a program starting out in Division I and be where we are now. And you know, the growth has been tremendous. I mean, through not only, you know, our on-field performance, but, you know, even just the support from the school. I mean, where our conference has come with the Northeast Conference and, you know, early on we were kind of trying to find our way with what conference we were going to be in and played in the CAA a little bit before the NEC formed. So,
now
that the NEC is, you know, well established, you know, I mean, we've certainly tried to create our identity within that conference and, you know, now trying to get to a national level. So, kind of culminating last year and, you know, getting an NCAA tournament win and being able to give Maryland a run for their money and, you know, even more excited about what we're capable of doing moving forward into this year.
So, Coach, I just got to say this, man, with my background. We were talking before the call, and he told me he's a native Pittsburgher. Went on and played Providence. But, man, how cool is it to see a guy not from a historical traditional area leading a D1 team? Man, I'm proud of you. That's awesome.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I mean, it really couldn't have been a better situation for me when I graduated from Providence and moved back home and was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with the next steps. Bear Davis, who was the head coach of our program at the time, who's now with the Ohio Machine, had established some communication with me knowing I was back in the area, and we talked and then hopped on board as a volunteer in year one and then, you know, kind of never looked back from there through becoming a graduate assistant and then a full-time assistant and then, you know, eventually becoming the head coach when Coach Davis had moved on.
Well, I just think it's awesome, man. I just think it's awesome. Coach, I noticed looking at the roster, man, you got such a high content of Canadian players. What's your pipeline?
Yeah, I mean, we started out, I mean, Coach Davis had a couple guys that had gone under the radar in year one. I mean, we had Andrew Watt back then, who was a U19 player that, you know, essentially wasn't recruited by another Division I school and actually just retired, had a, you know, double-digit career in the NLL there. And he was kind of the first find, Michael Fleming back then, and Jeff Gilbert, who's played in the NLL through all these years. And you know, a couple steals early on, and then that was what established our pipeline in Ontario, just kind of with the proximity, because, you know, from here to Toronto, we're only looking at about 4.5 hours, so realized that could be a niche for us early on, and then, you know, really started to go bigger and bigger with, you know, just realizing we could find some kids that were going under the radar. And then once we established ourselves in, you know, in Ontario, just kind of tried to keep branding ourselves all throughout Canada and, connected with some of the programs out west with the Claremont School and with Jeff Snyder running the Elevate program, and you know, just had our connections throughout all of Canada to where we've established ourselves in multiple provinces, and you know, continue to have that be a niche in our recruiting year to year.
Yeah, and I know from coaching on the national travel circuit, you know, with the Copperheads, it was crazy when those Western Canada travel teams would play, you know, either in Denver or at that old Bryan Invitational out there. We went out there and played a couple of times. You know, the difference between the Ontario lacrosse player and the Western Provinces lacrosse player was those guys were all like 6'2 or 6'3 with the exact same skills.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
you know,
absolutely.
I mean, when first played those guys from Calgary, I'm going like, oh, my gosh. You know, not only are they incredible, you know, stick handlers, but they're huge, you know.
Yeah, and the game, I mean, the games just continue to grow out there. I mean, Ontario, especially in the box lacrosse world, you know, it dominated the junior A circuit. And, you know, BC is certainly caught up, and you see Coquitlam get in the mix each year and be able to compete for a Minto. And then, you know, last year having Alberta get some wins in the Minto Cup, I mean, they're just, you know, the game's growing so much, like, everywhere, and you're seeing the gap even close, and, you know, throughout the provinces of Canada where those Western, you know, with BC and Alberta, they're really starting to catch up to Ontario.
So, Coach, in the time you've been there, man, and from when you played, might you be able to, understanding that fall is different than spring, and you know, a lot of our listeners, you know, come spring, they're playing two games a week, you know, so that definitely makes the schematics of the weekly plan a little bit different. But can you take me through a general snapshot or a template that you guys use for your planning? Do you have a general template? Do you change it? I mean, in terms of obviously changing the drills, but do you change that up all the time? Is it radically different than it was when you first started coaching? Can you just give me a general rundown of a practice plan philosophy, and then we'll talk about some of the specifics as I reference back to your stats here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we certainly get into, you know, some routines where, you know, we get back to, you know, a certain amount of time spent in different areas each practice where, you know, we designate a certain amount of time for stick work to get things going at the beginning of practice, and we change those drills up a good bit, but you know, pretty routinely we're getting the sticks going with getting as many touches as we can to start off. You know, and
are you an afternoon practice guy? Coach,
yeah,
are you an afternoon practice guy?
Yeah, we typically practice mid-afternoon. We'll do our lifting in the morning before classes, and that's kind of our way to get them out of bed early on certain days. But,
right.
You know, with classes, I mean, they're typically starting their classes in the morning and for the most part finishing their day by the time we start practice at 1. So gives them a little bit more of a standard day of more of like an 8 to 3:30, 8 to 4. So, but, yeah, we typically normally gone around, you know, noon or the early afternoon.
Okay. So the guys come out, and we've got them doing some stick work?
Yeah, they'll get into stick work right away. I mean, we kind of start out informally with our stick work every day where they're literally just doing some partner passing and, you know, getting the sticks going. And we try to get creative with that, and we want them to have fun when they come out and do that where, you know, we throw in some different stuff. I mean, we'll throw in, you know, people would probably watch us and think we're crazy going through it all, but, you know, we want them to develop their sticks in different ways where we'll have them do underhand passing, we'll have them do one-handed underhand passing, we'll have them do behind-the-back passing, we'll have them do around-the-world passing, and, you know, kind of just be creative and let them enjoy it when we kind of get out there and on the field, and we feel that that kind of starts the tempo to, you know, to enjoy the game, you know, as soon as you step foot on the field. So, you know, we'll typically do that for about 10 or 15 minutes, and once we break out into our stretch and warm the goalies up, we'll then, like I said, normally isolate some stick work drills, you know, even beyond that for the first, you know, we'll run probably, you know, 3 stick work drills for about 6 or 7 minutes apiece tops. And that's, you know, really based upon efficiency of, again, not having lines, not, you know, having guys standing around too often, but just getting as many touches as possible. And then we'll roll in. I mean, we're obviously a highly transition-oriented team, and, you know, transition drills are a part of our practice every single day. So,
Come out of the stretch, wait a second, man. When you come out of the stretch and you warm up goalies, are you the guy that warms up the goalies?
I still do. It's where I get to put a stick in my hand still. So,
every goalie we've ever interviewed, you know, at the top of the list, guys like Kadelka, right? Goalie we've ever interviewed, even at the high school level, that are head coaches, all think they should be the guy warming up goalies, man. It must be in your DNA.
I don't know. I mean, my excuse is always that I'm trying to make up for all the goals that I let in, and I'm trying to even up the score. But, for whatever reason, it's always stuck with me where I've enjoyed doing it. It just gets me active to kind of start off the practice as well. So, but we'll have the guy. I mean, we rotate as coaches with warming up the goalies every day, and then we'll throw.
No, I'm just kidding, man. I'm just kidding. Yeah. Yeah, although Kadelka is still all left, in case you were wondering. I've actually been to their practice, but nonetheless.
Yeah, my goal is for our goalies to not know which hand I am, because in college they certainly would have known. So, but yeah, it's a way to, like I said, get active to start off the practice. I still enjoy doing it. So the rest of the practice, I get the stick out of my hands, but those 15 minutes, I'm making up for lost time with the goals that I went in. So.
Goalies always think they should be the warm-up guy. I laugh. Yeah. All right. So now we've stretched.
We all think we're great shooters now, too.
I'm not saying anything, man. I mean, you're a big-time D1 coach. I'm just a club, high school, varsity. I coached at Auburn for quite a while, but in the MCLA. But, no, man, my hat's off to you. I quit warming up. I'm 62, man. I quit warming up goalies about 20 years ago just because it was embarrassing. You know, you fall over, you know, the walker gets in the way when you're trying to go left and split. It's just awful.
But, yeah, we will, after we kind of get through the stick work portion, like I said, we'll normally kind of jump right into transition. Our practices are normally, I mean, when you throw stick work and transition together with those segments, I mean, we're normally, you know, taking up about 60% of our practice time. And again, that's, you know, the way that we feel we're most efficient with getting guys touches. And, you know, we also like just creating an urgency that, you know, is apparent on game days that's hard to create, you know, within a practice environment. But, you know, we feel like when there's little downtime and guys don't have time to stand in between reps and, you know, wait in a line, that it just kind of, you know, at least facilitates the drills to set up for, you know, more of an urgent, you know, environment, so to speak. And, you know, that's what we're constantly trying to create, is just that urgency that is present on game days, whether you like it or not. So, you know, the shorter drill segments.
Yeah, do you keep the clock on for your drills?
We do. Yeah, the clock's on all throughout practice, and we run. I mean, a lot of our drills will manufacture some short shot clocks as well. That's one of the ways we emphasize. I mean, we break down kind of the different areas where you can get a number advantage. And we'll simulate some drills to kind of, you know, more so go along with each one of those areas. So, you know, we'll break down that number. I mean, essentially our breakdown of where number advantages come from are rides, clears, ground balls, quick whistles, subbing, and what am I forgetting? Forgetting one. But we'll take each area, and I believe I left out face-offs, but we'll take each one of those areas, and a lot of times we'll just manufacture shot clocks within drills, where, for instance, if we're throwing out multiple ground balls, as soon as the possession's won and you're in the offensive end, it's an immediate 15-second shot clock. You know, and we'll do that with, you know, each one of those areas. When we'll run clearing drills, same exact thing. I mean, the time's on the clock, and then we'll also have somebody working the shot clock that, you know, the second you step over midfield, that 15-second shot clock goes on. And we'll do it with face-offs as well. I mean, we'll run kind of a rapid full-field face-off setup where, you know, it's just one face-off after the next, where we're subbing guys in very quickly. But, you know, it's literally just take the draw, 15-second shot clock's on as soon as the possession's won, whatever happens with the way that plays out, line up for a new face-off right away. And, I mean, we'll typically get, I mean, normally at least three face-offs, you know, going 15 seconds apiece per minute, because we have such little downtime in between the reps. So over a, you know, 7 or 8 minute period, you know, we're looking at repping out, you know, 20 to 25, you know, face-offs with a 15-second shot clock on. You know, so the clock for us, and having that visible, and also using that shot clock element, is a huge part of the way that we go through our drills. And again, that's just one of those things that, you know, we feel creates some urgency, where it takes the thinking out of the equation and makes it more like a game day.
Coach, I just developed a man crush on you. Man, I love that. I'm kind of trained under Berkman, you know, so, you know, our practices are, you know, 200 touches in the first hour, another 100 after that, trying to do the same thing. Man, I've been interviewing coaches a long time, right, and coaching clinics and doing coaching clinics and attending coaching clinics. I have not heard the 15-second shot clock in a transition drill over the midfield line. Where'd you get that idea?
We just, I mean, essentially just wanted, especially when we were working rides and clears, it kind of started with that where, you know, we were always trying to, I think a lot of people try to incorporate riding and clearing into drills, which we've always liked, but at the same time, like when we run 6v6, since we do it, you know, very seldom, you know, relatively speaking, we kind of isolate that. We're like, hey, we just want to, you know, we just want to run 6v6. We're not going to hit riding and clearing in this segment. And then when we'd isolate riding and clearing, we just, you know, again, trying to look at things from an efficiency standpoint, we were like, what's the best way we can kind of push our philosophy with going to the cage right away, with being aggressive, and also get as many reps as we can with, you know, trying to keep things under, you know, 8 or 9 minutes a drill. So that was kind of one of the ways we came up with it and just said, hey, this kind of kills two birds with one stone where we're getting multiple reps. It eliminates downtime. Then we're also just creating that urgency and aggressive mindset to push the cage.
Coach, I am absolutely in love and enamored with this idea because, you know, we get so many emails from coaches, you know, especially high school coaches or rec coaches or even club coaches, you know, just really struggling with how to keep energy in their clearing drills, you know, or their riding drills. And I had one guy tell me, like a 30-year veteran, I think he played in North Carolina or something, in an email, saying, hey, man, why is it that whenever I'm a high school coach and I work on clears, it automatically starts to rain? Yeah, and it's like metaphor was, you're like yelling down the field. The kid's attention span is like, you know, minuscule. And it's just hard, 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 you know, to keep a high school kid's attention, especially if you're putting in a second ride or a second clear or, you know, your roster is stretched. So, you know, you got an eighth grader filling in on the ride or something at the high school level. I just think that's an incredible way to put energy and passion back in rides and clears, man. That's a great idea.
Yeah, and we've just
have
found
a shot clock for
there.
How long it takes. You should have 15 seconds for him to get it over the midfield line or something.
Yeah, I mean, we typically, I mean, with us, I mean, we push the ball out so quickly that it's, you know, very rarely an issue that we're not getting it over the midfield quickly. But that's a whole other element we could add where it's 15 seconds to get over and then 15 seconds to create from there. But we'll run that as a competition as well, where it's like if you just successfully clear and you don't get a shot off, or if you get a shot off and you don't score, it's just 1 point. And then, you know, if you score on it, it's 2. And if you score off the ride, it's 2. And we just go right back and forth, you know, again, competitively, where we can get, you know, a ton of reps in a short period of time and, you know, again, kind of hit a bunch of different aspects that we're trying to get out of it with fast play and, you know, efficiency in between reps and, again, just creating that urgent mindset at all times.
So, Coach, let me ask you a question. When you configure the teams for this, are you structuring this ones against ones, or is the whole team just totally mixed up?
We'll typically mix up the whole team. I mean, especially depending on the time of the year. I mean, in the fall, you know, we very rarely really isolate kind of who we expect to be starters at that point.
Right.
So it's really a mixed bag. And, you know, at times we'll even, you know, that could be split where with us, I mean, we typically carry 40 to 45. So we'll even take half the team and put them on, you know, put them off to the side where they're hitting shooting or hitting some footwork with the D guys or, you know, again, anytime we realize there's too many people standing around, we eliminate that. So we'll even split that into two groups and, you know, have half the team running against each other, and then they swap and, you know, hit drills on the side. But, yeah, it's typically we want all, especially in those full field encompassing drills before we get into the, you know, the scouting reports and into the actual thick of the season, we're you know, kind of ignoring the depth chart, so to speak, at that point in time.
So, Coach, when you come out of the stretch and you're going to get the pace of practice up in a transition drill with a 15-second shot clock, I'm hearing that a lot of times that first drill out of the gates is a full field. Do you do that, or are you running 3v2s, 4v3s?
Yeah, a lot of times
smaller
it
fields,
is.
Or do you mix it up?
We mix it up. I mean, we'll typically either, I mean, when we finish our stretch and we hit our stick work, I mean, we're either going to split them into position work to start out and, you know, more so hit some positional stuff, or else we will get into, you know, more of an out of the gate. As long as we've hit enough stick work, then, you know, we feel we're ready for a full field drill, then we'll start out with a full field transition drill, or we'll do some of the more West Jennies where, you know, we'll run it with 3v2s, 4v3s, 5v4s, all the way up to 6v5s. So, you know, we do that in different, you know, different lengths on the field. If we run 3v2s, we're typically more on like a 30-yard field. If we're, you know, up into 4v3s, we go up to 40 and then, you know, all the way up to 6v5s with full field. where everybody's playing every position during those.
I love it. Just for the
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I want to give you some kudos here, man, just for the listeners, edification. Did you hear that word, Coach? Edification? That's like a grown-up, multi-syllable world, man. Just trying to impress you, one Pittsburgher to another. Pittsburgh never leaves your blood. I mean, it's in there. Anyway, clearing percentage last year is at 9-10. You got to be pretty happy with that, man. I mean, I think the NCAA averaged like 87, 88. So the clears are definitely getting up and out and, you know, putting you right in the transition sweet spot where you want to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we're very pleased with our efficiency there overall last year because we try to create so much in those areas that, you know, oftentimes our aggressiveness can, you know, can result in a couple more turnovers a game, which, you know, we live and die by. But, you know, last year that was certainly a huge part of our success was, you know, we weren't only getting offense out of the clears, but, you know, when we weren't getting offense, we were just very efficient with getting the ball possessed and down to the other end. So, you know, it's certainly something that, like I said, was a big part of our success was not turning the ball over in those areas, even though at the same time we were being very aggressive to try to push offense.
Well, and, you know, we try and tell coaches all the time, like if I get asked to do a coaching clinic, you know, on what I've learned, I'm not that smart. It's not my stuff, man. But, you know, I try and always emphasize to the coaches, you know, well, I want to play like this team. I want to play like that team. I want to be transition. I want to be, you know, balls to the wall on fire, man, just going out there and getting it done. You got to tell them, you got to understand, man, you're going to give up some transition opportunities if you make that kind of commitment to the transition as the philosophy of your offense. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
And, I cringe when I see a guy, you know, the kids are just playing the way they've been coached to play, the culture they've been placed, taught to play in, the practice philosophies that they practice every day. You know, and then they may make an error, or maybe somebody makes a great play, or, you know, whatever it is, and the coaches go nuts. You know, when they give up a goal in transition, you got to understand, you know, it comes with the territory, right? I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for us, I mean, you know, we kind of, again, we're going to play our style and understand that, you know, at times you can put yourself in vulnerable situations, but, you know, we also just feel that, you know, when you play at that pace and try to, you know, essentially outpace your opponent, you know, you're going to create a lot of exciting opportunities and, you know, hopefully be able to fill the ball up in the back of the net more than they can. So we're very rarely, you know, focusing on reducing turnovers. I mean, we talk to the guys about more so making mistakes at the fastest pace possible when we practice, you know, and be willing to make a mistake and move on to that next play. And, you know, that builds into our philosophy as well, because when we want to play so fast and we don't have time to react to mistakes, you know, and when we're telling the guys that, we certainly can't, you know, coach in an opposite way where as soon as they throw the ball away, we're, you know, losing our mind on the kids because,
right,
again, that's what we're pushing. We're saying, hey, now it's about that next play that you have to make. So,
well, and I think that's a really, really key point, you know, that you make. So, Coach, man, this interview is going a different direction than I expected. Let me, can I ask you some personal questions about my own coaching?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and for the listeners, just talk amongst yourselves for a second, okay? Coach, as I get older, man, and I think I've coached in 24 championship games, okay? I start to doubt my transition philosophies sometimes, you know, at the end of the game, and trying to find a balance where we're playing a team that's at least as good as us, but our guys have played really, really well that day. There's 6 minutes left in the game, and we're up two. You know, and I, to be honest with you, man, you know, I've evolved the other way. I mean, we actually had a great talk with Lars Tiffany on this subject. He's got a call he calls Brown, and even though they're pushing the pedal, you know, they're going to take 30 or 45 seconds off, you know, at the 5 or 6 minute mark. Do you wrestle with that as a coach in terms of taking the foot off the pedal to elongate the position or get some of that time off the clock? Or do you just live with it the way it is? And I ask you this, like I said, extremely personal to me because I've actually come back the other way a little bit, but I see the, what's the right word, not confusion, but the anxiety, you know, it creates with the players because you're basically contradicting what you just did every day in practice. Does that make sense, the way I phrased that question to you? I mean, do you wrestle with that or think about it?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, I wrestle with it, and I have to tell the assistants to wrestle with me during games if I'm getting too aggressive. So there's certainly times where you can take your foot off the gas, and those situations, like you mentioned, where the, you know, the game's getting down to crunch time, and, you know, it's a one- or two-goal game, you know, it's, you know, that battle of, do you want to be aggressive and try to get one more in the back of the net, or do you want to try to, you know, take the air out of the sails, so to speak, and slow the ball down and, you know, start putting the other team in panic mode, you know, with having to get the ball back and for them to create. And I think for us, it's, you know, it's really a game-by-game management. You know, or depending on the score of the game, depending on how confident we feel that, you know, there's going to be more possessions throughout the rest of the game. I mean, if it's a game with less possessions, then there's a good chance
Yeah, I mean, I guess I never really considered that. That's a great point. If you're playing a team that's going to go down there and be extremely deliberate, you know, that probably has to factor into your decision process as well, eh? I mean...
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've tried to come up with rules over the years, and quite honestly, we'd have to come up with 75 rules. You know, with if up by two in this situation with 3 minutes left, we're going to hold. If up by three, you know, and try to work
through. Oh, God, Coach, I'm not that smart.
And,
yeah, I couldn't figure that out.
I'm not either, and that's why I just said, hey, we're going to have to trust our instincts at times and, you know, read the game situation and decide what we think is best. But I think the most important thing you mentioned is, you know, when you run a certain style and you run a philosophy of, hey, we're going to push, 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 and then all of a sudden you get into those moments where you're like, are we going to keep pushing or are we going to pull our foot off the gas? And I think the most important thing is to immediately communicate that and get everybody on the same page, because I think where at times we all err is, you know, more so when you lack that communication because of your own uncertainty, and then it's how do you expect your players to have certainty of what to do when, you know, you're not certain. You know, so it's kind of at least, you know, evaluating the situation as quickly as you possibly can and then making sure there's full communication. And, you know, to your point, we have a call as well, like you mentioned, with Coach Tiffany at Virginia there. And, you know, we have a call where we immediately just decide, hey, we're going to pull our foot off the gas. We're not going to the cage right now, because our guys expect if they don't hear anything in any situation that they have the green
then
light to
going.
Go.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and I guess that kind of listeners, get ready. We're coming back into the podcast here in just a second. But for me, you know, I've told the kids, understand, man, you know, when we say we're going to take some time off, we're talking about taking 45 seconds to like a minute 10, a minute 15. You know, I don't, unless it's the last 45 seconds of the game and we're up two, you know, that's a horse of a different color. But if there's 5 or 6 minutes left, which I think is when you really got to start to make those decisions, right? I mean, I don't want to be in a one-goal game with a minute left if I could have taken a minute and a half off at the five-minute mark and reduced the chances of that even happening. You know, that's one thing where I've really changed, I think, is I start to think about this stuff with six or seven. And again, for me, it's more when I'm playing a team that I'm really, really worried about. You know, with somebody that's as good as us or somebody that I think is even better than us, we're just playing really well that day, you know, or the kids are really performing or, you know, maybe we found something in a scouting report or there's a matchup we like or somebody's hot or, you know, whatever it turns out to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, so thanks for the personal coaching advice there. You can send me a bill. And we'll bring the listeners back in. So now we've been through the stretch, man. We got into a transition drill. Is there a place we go from here, Coach, or are we still working on different transition looks?
Yeah, I mean, we'll build up. I mean, like I said, we'll do some stick work build up where we're increasing the touches. Then we get into the transition, which a lot of times we will start on a smaller, you know, smaller field and then kind of build our way up to a bigger field. 6v6, I mean, the one thing that we like to do is split it up into, you know, a couple different segments. We've just found that, you know, especially when you're, you know, doing a long segment of 6v6, it just, you know, completed earlier I mentioned just how we're always trying to create that urgency and put guys in a game-like mindset. And I just feel like with elongated 6v6 sessions where, you know, you can get every possession back regardless of what happens, you throw the ball away or, you know, Tommy takes a terrible shot and it's just, oh, grab another one off the end line. You know, it's just it's not what we want to create as far as just the environment that we're trying to simulate that's like game days. So for us, a lot of times we'll break out as we'll typically not hit 6v6 until the second half of practice. So we'll hit, you know, an 8-minute segment and then go back to transition and then hit another 8-minute segment and then go back to transition and then maybe even hit like a third one. You know, but we more so when we do those, the other thing that we'll typically do is we'll score them within 6v6. You know, again, the same concept of trying to eliminate, you know, just kind of a complacent mindset where you're not really accountable for the, you know, the results that are taking place in those segments. So to counter that, we'll, you know, keep score. We're typically, you know, we say the offense, our goal is to score at 33% efficiency in 6v6 situations. So we do it to make it an even score. The defense, when they get a stop, they get 1 point. When the offense scores a goal, they get 2 points. And we'll run that throughout, or we'll have a little bit of a consequence for the losers afterwards. But again, it puts the, you know, the same type of mindset in a game where the ball matters, the possession matters, and, you know, again, there's still an urgency and a competitive nature, you know, that I think a lot of times people lose in 6v6 segments, especially when you are doing elongated ones that, you know, the kids just have 20 minutes to kind of, you know, to play at whatever level they kind of feel like.
Man, I am digging you. All right, I got a couple of questions. In the last 10 years of interviewing coaches, really, Coach, when I think we started, everybody was, I mean, when there started to be a movement in NCAA lacrosse back into the transition drills, I mean, I can remember even when we interviewed Bill Tierney when he was still at Princeton talking about how he needed to totally change the way they practiced because he'd had an off year, if I remember right. They didn't make the tournament, and I think they were 500 or close to it, and, you know, he called a team meeting and said, hey, listen, you know, you're not having any fun. I'm not having any fun. Yeah, the more fun we don't have, the more I overcoach. You know, we're going to change the way we practice, even with their slowdown offense, or, excuse me, deliberate offense, let me say it that way, you know, moving into transition. But here's my question. At that time, you know, most of the coaches that we did podcasts with were focusing on the transition and a build-up. You know, it would be a 3v2 and then a 4v3 or a 5v4, or maybe they skip a step or go 6v5. And then in the last 3 or 4 years, we've heard on the podcast more of a philosophy to make it so the players cannot anticipate, you know, what the next drill is or where the ball's going to go or stuff like that. So they may come out with a 6v5 and then maybe even do 4v4 or 6v6 and then go into a 3v2. In other words, the build-up for a lot of the coaches wasn't nearly as effective in their own mind as changing the scenario during practice consistent with the way the ebbs and flows go in a game, if I said that question so you can understand it. So do you see yourself more in a build-up camp on the transition stuff or more somebody that is just totally mixing up the transition drills? I think I know the answer to the question already.
Yeah, we'll do both. Especially in the fall.
Now, both isn't an answer. You can't say both, Coach.
I can explain each one to you, though, so I'll have a reason for it. But we separate our transition drills into either what we call build-up drills, which is exactly what you just mentioned, with starting with 2v1s and working our way up. And then we separate them into what we call recognition drills, where, you know, different breaks take place within those drills, and you have to actually recognize what the number advantages are. But in the fall and in the preseason and kind of at the beginning of practice is more when we run the West Jennies, run the 2v1s, the 3v2s, and, you know, the build-up drills, where it's, you know, a lot easier to just focus on kind of the fundamentals of what we want to be doing within transition. And then, you know, and the guys know, hey, now we're going into a transition recognition drill. You know, all breaks can take place, and the main emphasis is getting everybody on the same page and communicating and making sure that we run our breaks correctly. So as we get into the later, you know, the latter half of the season, we'll certainly run a lot more of the recognition type drills, just because they are more all comprehensive, like you said. But I always find a time and a place to just go back to the simple ones. You know, I mean, again, when we run, you know, our broken down drills, we'll do a lot of different stations where we'll have certain guys doing 2v1s where, you know, it's the West Jenny format, and then we'll do 2v1 ground balls to the cage, and then, you know, a 2v1 drill attacking from behind. You know, and we'll mix those simple ones in just because, again, no matter what type of transition you're running, you know, those small fundamentals come into play, and eventually those numbers break down into a 2v1 typically. So You know, we find a time and a place for both, but, you know, certainly feel it's more the educational approach with the build-up and then more of the, you know, full comprehensive approach, you know, with the recognition type drills. So can I say both with that description?
You're like kicking my ass, man. I mean, I just, yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, the Kool-Aid that I love to coach and I love to drink, you're doing it just on a much more higher level, if you will. So these recognition transition drills, you know, aside from, you know, something basic at the midfield line, or now teams are running it more from the far restraining line, right? I mean, for you go white and blue in practice, coach, or are you white and red?
We go white and red.
Okay, so, I mean, it's like four red, three white, or five red, three white, or, you know, add ones. Can you give me an example of maybe what your favorite recognition transition drill might be?
Yeah, I mean, we'll do, I mean, a number of them. I mean, one of the ones we run that's pretty common, we run what we call our 55 drill. A lot of different people have different names for it, but essentially you have your attack and defense in on each end. And then you have two lines of midfielders, you know, on
right.
each side, more so towards the sidelines. And we'll mix and match with that. I mean, one of the things that we do to kind of create different scenarios is we even randomly call out guys to just drop and hit a push-up, where the attack then has to recognize how many people are getting in offensively. The D obviously has to recognize how many people are getting in off or defensively, and then, you know, call those breaks accordingly. But we, within some of those drills that would otherwise be even, you know, we'll do a lot where we just do grab a guy out and just have him hit a push up off to the side and then pop right back into the drill. And, you know, the other thing that we feel that does is also just create, you know, a chaser or a trail guy, you know, within
right.
each drill. And we even do that with all of our West Jennies. Most people do where the last guy touches the ball is out. You know, for us, whether we're running it in a 2v1 format all the way up to a 6v5 format, we do it that last guy that touches either has to run around the net and then he's chasing back on defense, or again, drop and do like two push-ups and then he's dropping back to get back on D. But even
well,
just throwing
that,
yeah, I mean, we throw that little caveat into each one of our transition drills just because, you know, again, it will create different numbers. You can do it with a guy on offense. You can do it with a guy on defense. And then it, again, you know, something I keep getting back to, but just creates that urgency where, you know, when you don't have that, guys are going to slow down and, you know, play to the pace that they're capable of playing within that drill. You know, but you throw that chaser in and it's more like a live situation that's going to take place in the game where the D is coming in to even up. So, but yeah, we run the 55 one a lot. We'll run what we call Wolverine, where, again, attack and most of our recognition ones, the attack and D are already in at both ends, and we kind of do different mix-ups to, you know, to make the numbers different at the midfield. But we'll run what we call Wolverine, where it's just, and again, this is a common one I'm sure you've heard many times before, but, you know, two color versus one on one side, two versus one on the other side, where, you know, it's a full ground ball on one side. If the, you know, the team of two wins it, the other side automatically releases, you know, coming into even up. And then if the team of one wins it, we wait until there's a pass or a shot, you know, and then we always send it back the other way, which again, now depending on the way that panned out and when the other side released, you know, you're typically going to get a different number advantage almost every time when you send it the opposite way. So we used to do it just one direction. And then we found just getting that extra clear going in the opposite, you know, in the opposite direction just ended up adding in a second transition segment that, you know, again, was typically producing different numbers each time.
Man, coach, I love that idea, too. I've never done that. Always just done it one way.
Yeah, and another, I mean, again, we try to emulate, you know, live situations as much as we can, too, where some of our drills, I mean, you know, as simple as it is, we're almost just trying to isolate a certain segment of the game. And, you know, even for us, I mean, you know, we'll run, again, stuff you've obviously come across before and have heard many other coaches say, but, you know, we'll do like what we call the off-the-save drill and we'll designate where the ball is going to get outletted from after each shot. So we might put a 30-second shot clock on where once you cross midfield, you have 30 seconds to shoot. It's a live segment. The second that shot comes, we will either say that the goalie is going to pull it out of the cage and they can have one ready to outlet right away, or we'll say it's going to come off the end line right away, or we'll have one that we just roll a ball out to the opposite end of the field as soon as that shot's taken and create a scramble situation in the 3v3. But, you know, again, just having those different segments where, you know, you can, and that too, like I said, we'll grab a guy and just say, hey, 55, hit one, and they pop out of the drill, hit a push-up, and then they're popping back in, just to keep changing up the numbers to make sure that it is different recognition each time. So maybe less creative on our part because we're really just trying to, you know, basically isolate an exact segment that takes place in a live scenario. We just feel what better way to practice at times than do exactly what you're actually doing in a game.
Well, and the thing that's running through my mind as I'm listening to you talk is, you know, hopefully, you know, comments that I long for from players that I get to coach, and that is just how much they enjoy practice and how much fun it is. I mean, when you're changing it up these kind of ways, not only is it challenging for the players because they kind of got to think, you know, even if they're a little bit tired or especially when they're sprinting up and down. But this is all really, really, not only do we get a lot of touches and we capitalize on the transition philosophy, but at the end of the day, these drills are a blast to run for the players.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, we feel more and more. I mean, you had touched on just kind of our, you know, if our philosophy's changed over the years. I mean, quite honestly, Mike, we keep getting shorter and shorter with our practices and, you know, trying to find a way to just be more efficient. And, you know, again, we just feel the guys love practicing that way. I mean, it's so rare for us to go beyond an hour and a half out on the field. You know, and we don't stop and talk much when we're out there. You know, I mean, I always tell our assistants when we're on that field, we want to use it. So, you know, we try to, if we're going to stop practice and have to hit a point, I mean, of course, there's a time and place for it. But, you know, the more I've gotten into coaching and the more years that have gone by, I've talked less and let them play more. You know, and kind of eat your humble pie and realize they're getting better by practicing than they are by sitting around and listening to you. And, you know, with that, when we stop a drill, we even now try to more so, you know, make it like a timeout in the game where it's, let's bring them in as quickly as possible, you know, no more than a minute and a half or two of talking points, tell them what we need, you know, what we feel that they need to hear, and then send them right back out. And we have the luxury at the college level, of course, of them being able to do a film session the next day and, you know, have things broken down where we don't have to do that stuff on the field. But, you know, if, you know, you have that capability, I mean, I've certainly felt that it's been such a useful approach for us is, you know, hit our teaching kind of outside of, you know, just when we're on that field, you know, and being an I mean, I had my master's in education, obviously just, you know, differentiating learning techniques and teaching techniques is something that we try to think of. And there's a time and the place to do walkthroughs and demos on the field, and some guys have that click, you know, more with them than if you're sitting in a film room or, you know, drawing something up on a board. So we try to do all of it, but, you know, again, we try to more so use that field to let them play and let them get touches when they're out there, and then, you know, we can address the subtleties the next day of what we want to see improvement on, and that way when we get back out there, they can just go right back at it again and not have to listen to us too much and have fun playing the game.
Well, and I think, you know, when you talk about learning philosophies, it's a key point because the, and I say this with affection, not sarcasm, and I'm very serious about that. You know, the ADD nature of the kids, you know, comes with the ability to multitask and a lot of positive things compared to maybe my era of players or even the era between me and these players or 12 eras of players between me and these players. But, you know, my experience has been putting them in a classroom for not a long time, 8 to 10 minutes, before practice when you're going to draw up a new look or you've seen something on film and you show them the film and then talk about how we might adjust to it or something we might be able to surprise them with a hybrid type of slide or whatever it turns out to be. You know, they just seem to be so much more receptive learning, X's and O's in the classroom. And I tell this to coaches all the time on and off the air and emails and clinics. You know, the days of grabbing Johnny by the shirt and saying, when Billy goes here, you go here. Those days are over.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I'm
generalizing. I mean, I get that, you know, but, yeah, if you don't have the ability to, you know, break your positions up and show them specific film every day, you know, even 7 or 8 minutes, on something that happened in a game and a drill, you're going to adjust to it with a consequence, being how we're going to play this differently, maybe, you know, that little time in the classroom can be save you so much frustration that you would get on the field because the guys aren't paying attention or you don't think they're paying attention or keeping 40 guys interested is a bear, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, even with 18 to 22-year-olds, you expect a little bit better of attention span. But, you know, it is a challenge at times, and we just feel like we can be, you know, again, more efficient with what we're trying to get across at times, you know, when we're in the classroom or, you know, again, doing a smaller isolated segment on the field, where if we are going to do a walkthrough or more so demo, you know, live on the field, we even just put that at the beginning of practice and not mix it in, because, you know, we felt like, you know, when we originally were in situations where we'd go to introduce something new for a drill and the guys stand around for 10 minutes and we're like, all right, let's go. They're waking up, you know, to get back into practice, because they probably tuned us out about 2 minutes into the demo, you know, where we feel
well,
like
at
we
the end
do
of the
that
day,
stuff.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I think it's the way you have to coach now. I mean, you know, you can browbeat them into the way you used to do it, but it's not successful. You know, I mean, if this is, you know, they want to play, or excuse me, you know, the attention span isn't great, then, you know, modify your coaching accordingly to deal with that. You know, I mean, rather than turn it out to be a battle of philosophies, you know?
Yeah, exactly. No, I couldn't agree more.
And I think that's a challenge for more experienced coaches. But I can't, you know, I can tell you from the emails that we get, and I probably get 50 a month, oh my gosh, you know, we started doing what Coach McKinn said, and, you know, the players lit up like Christmas trees, man. I mean, once they do it, the light bulb goes on, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I still remember talking or listening to a talk at the convention from Coach Nagel, who's at Colgate at the time and Stony Brook now, but, you know, he kind of alluded to the point of just, you know, eliminating the downtime and the talking on the field, and that, you know, the kids aren't listening nearly as much as you think they are. And, you know, I was kind of looking at myself in the mirror at the time, like, oh man, is he talking to me? And,
yeah.
You know, as a young coach,
yeah,
felt like I could more, you know, shed my wisdom and enlighten the guys and, you know, use my voice to make them much better players. And you just realize more and more, it's like they got to play the game and learn and develop on their own. And, you know, again, that's why it's so much of our drills, I mean, we talk about urgency and putting them in game-like situations, because, you know, we just feel that when you play with that mindset, I mean, you develop instincts, you know, when you're constantly playing with an urgency, because, again, on game days, that's the way it is, whether you like it or not. So the more we can put guys in situations where they have to instinctively react, you know, then we feel that's what's making them better lacrosse players, as opposed to, you know, trying to script something out and tell them what to do. So not even, I mean, to that point, I remember one of the years we were number one in the country in man-up offense. We were going through our plays. I was coaching our man up, and we were about halfway through the season. And we had four or five set plays that, you know, we felt were our bread and butter and getting us great actions, and would work them every single time we'd run practice and do a man-up, man-down session. And, you know, about halfway through the season, I just went back through all our goals, and I was like, I want to see, you know, what play we've scored on the most, you know, exactly where our goals are coming from in these situations, what sets we're running. And I can't remember the exact numbers now, but it was literally like 80 or 90% of our goals were taking place after our plays were broken. You know, and without looking at them all in the year, I mean, I would not have thought that was going to be the case. And I felt like we were scoring more on our plays. And, you know, going back through, it's like, you know, to your point, do we beat our head against the wall and keep trying to do the same thing, or do we adapt and adjust accordingly? And, you know, we were sitting there saying, hey, we've scored, you know, say 3 or 4 goals running these plays that we work on every single day in practice, and we run for, you know, 70% of the man-up segment that we have in a game, and then all of a sudden when we get 10 seconds after that play breaks and we're doing something that we don't even practice on a daily basis, the guys are scoring more. You know, so again, one of those situations where you kind of eat your humble pie and you're like, maybe my plays aren't so great, and that's what's making us put the ball in the back of the net and, you know, need to let the guys create and be able to do things on their own at times. And sometimes coaching less is coaching more, I think.
Well, and the nature of the beast is, God, I feel like I'm like the Lars Tiffany fan of the day, even though he's a wonderful friend of our site and has become a friend of mine. But, you know, we were in a long conversation about offenses starting to redirect the ball topside instead of banging it through X back when, you know, Loyola was kind of running that Goucher offense and stuff like that. And Toomey gave credit, you know, to Hannon when he was at Goucher for what their philosophy and in terms of how they were redirecting topside. And we were talking about it was a deep philosophical conversation, as you can often get in with Lars. And at the end, there's like silence on the podcast for like 8 seconds. You know, I'm thinking maybe he hung up, you know, or maybe he left. I don't know. And then finally he just said, but at the end of the day, we can talk about this till we're green. Nothing happens till somebody beats somebody, anybody, anyway.
Yeah,
you know, and
exactly.
And by you know, having the bulk of the practice in these unsettled situations where the guys react. And then the other point I want to make for the coaches that are listening is, you know, this 15 second over the midfield line, or even if you don't have access to a clock on the field, counting out the last 30 seconds, 30, and then yelling out 20 or whatever it turns out to be, even if it's an injured player, you know, keeping track on his phone, you find that the players get much greater field awareness, because if you don't do that, I don't think they know how long 15 seconds is, you know, or how long 28 seconds is, you know. And even if we're, you know, even if we're tied or we're down one or whatever the situation is, or there's 15 seconds left in a man up, to your point, man, it's more time than I thought. You know, I don't need to overreact. I can look, or I can do this, or, you know, I got a couple opportunities before the shot clock buzzer goes, you know, whatever it may turn out to be. We don't always have access to clocks on the field, but we count out the last 30 seconds, you know, of every drill, or, you know, we'll play 30-second man-ups or whatever it turns out to be along those lines. Hey,
I was just going to say, when we're on the road, I mean, we run into that as well, where we don't have a clock at our disposal. But, I mean, quite honestly, I don't think it makes a huge difference. I mean, you want them being able to look at a clock, but to your point, when you're calling it out, it's creating that same type of urgency for them.
Well, and once they learn it, they learn it. I mean, kind of what you were referencing there, you know, once they adopt that style of play, or they have kind of an inherent sixth sense of what that time is, you know, you don't need the clock as much, because that's already, you know, in their mindset to a degree, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But I can remember years ago, you know, players coming to me, you know, saying, oh, I didn't realize how much time was left, you know, at the end of a quarter or something, and the guy's, you know, out there, you know, dodging in Arkansas or something, you know. And it's a subtle little thing, but once they learn it, they learn it. Hey, we're coming up on time, but I got to ask you one question, man. Speaking of man up, last year's conversion rate was 429. That's pretty outstanding, man. Any general philosophy or something that you're ingrained into your man, aside from having great players, don't answer me like Bevel. Oh, we got a great shooter. What's contributing to that success on man up? And the man down percentage, 229, that's equally as good. I mean, compared to the NCAA averages, which, again, I think are about 28, 29, 30% or something like that, Coach, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'd love to tell you we're doing some great coaching to make those numbers turn out the way that they did. But, you know, a lot of it is just letting the guys kind of play and having them develop, you know, more instincts on both sides of the ball, where, you know, that's one area where we typically do just go with our top unit against our top unit, because we just feel that, you know, we it's so rare for us to go to a second unit in the game. So a lot of times we'll break up with that segment. Instead of having everybody standing around, we'll put in another drill where the guys are shooting or hitting stick work that aren't a part of those units. But we'll have our ones go against each other. Again, we create a lot of competitions where it's more, you know, they have to find a way to get the results, and we're just facilitating, where we'll put 30 seconds on the clock and play it out for a point, you know, and put a minute on the clock and play it out for a point, and end up doing that as a competition. And, you know, again, letting the guys just play a lot. But from a man-up standpoint, to get to your question of kind of schematics, I mean, one thing we try to do that's pretty simple is just isolate 3v2s. You know, and again, with the game always breaking down to 2v1 scenarios, you know, we run things as simple as when somebody's in a five-man, you know, we run an open set or a 2-3-1 from up top, you know, or we'll have a guy at X, and then we put two guys on the wings, you know, to isolate the 3v2 attacking from X, where essentially right. That X guy is just going to attack either pipe, get him to draw, you know, and then we step into those gaps to create the two-on-one and create the rotations. And then when we're up to, if somebody runs a box in one, a lot of times we just run a 3-3, because then with two guys up top, you put your three against two up top, where, again, right. You get that top center guy to draw either wing, step behind, and then you're getting that next 2v1 in rotation there. So a lot of times we really just try to talk about isolating those 3v2s and figuring out where they are. And, you know, again, just going with our main concepts of what we look to do off ball, with stepping into the gaps and, you know, either drawing or moving the ball to the next guy. But, you know, we'll get some caveats here and there. We have got, you know, we get different cutting actions and, you know, do some things to try to get defenses heavy on one side of the field. But, you know, again, everything's kind of coming back to how do you simplify to get down to a 3v2 and a 2v1, you know, where we're not trying to make it too complex, where we're running, you know, difficult set plays or anything like that, or we're never pumping the ball into the crease too aggressively. You know, it's more so just how can we isolate number. You have a number advantage, you know, so how do you isolate that number advantage in the simplest way? And 6v5 is a lot harder to create offensively against a 2v1, obviously, and we're trying to figure out ways of how we can break down into an isolated 2v1.
Man, Coach, I have so enjoyed talking to you.
Listen, well, again,
we're up on an hour, man. I want to respect your time. Talk to me about prospect camps or how guys can get more information on Robert Morris Lacrosse.
Yeah, we have our prospect day coming up for the fall on October 13th. For us, I mean, that's all high school ages. So we bring guys in, we put them through drills. We obviously want to have some instruction be a part of that. And still always incorporate that into anything that we do. And then, you know, we let the guys play live a little bit as well, just for our own evaluation. But typically we run two in the summer, one in the fall. So we ran two this past summer, and then we have the one coming up October 13th. So.
Shoot, Coach, I didn't even look. Are those on your website, or is that a different website address?
They are, yeah, you can go through our website, and then it redirects you to our camp website, which is just good old Bobby Mo, as we refer to RMU here as. So we have BobbyMoLaxEvents.com.
I'm laughing, you know, because I was talking to Coach off the air and told him I have a nephew, you know, that has done real well in filming sports, but that graduated from there, I guess he's maybe 29 now or maybe 30, hockey guy. And when I was sending him texts during your NCAA run, I'm going, hey, man, you got to check out ESPN, look at your school, blah, 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 blah. You know, he's texting me back, go Bobby Moe. And I'm going, like, what in the hell is he talking about, man? I was unfamiliar with that nomenclature. And I just thought it was some kind of hip text talk, you know, that I was unfamiliar with and usually don't choose to admit to anybody, you know, that I'm that old or I don't have a clue on it. Anyway. Hey, Coach, stay on the line with me here 1 second. I'm on page 5 of my notes here. I got 3 or 4 things here I can write articles on. I'll figure it out, man. Again, Coach, I'm not patronizing you, man. I just fell in love with this dialogue about your practice plans, and if you'll come back, man, we'll have you back sooner rather than later, and I apologize now to myself and everybody else for not having you on sooner. Anyway,
no problem. Special thanks.
Coach McQuinn, great things happening out there in the Berg. Thanks so much for coming on with us. This is Last Coach Mike, lastcoachmike.com. Hey, man, remember, you got an awesome responsibility influencing the lives of these young people. Take it very seriously every day. Until next time, everybody.